where strategy gaming meets good vibes. No stress, just critical moves. So hello everybody, welcome back to Critical Moves. I'm Al, and today Nuno and I are joined by Dr. Luke Hughes, who is the main guy behind the upcoming Burden of Command game. Luke, are you well?
Am I well? We'll see after you work me over an interview. I hear this is going to be a hard-heading, ruthless, deeply personal podcast. So I've been strapped to the chair. I'm ready. Just start the pain.
There'll be no pain. There might be a little bit of pain, but there won't be too much pain.
I'm okay.
Good. We really appreciate you coming on and speaking to us. You are our first interviewee, so thank you so much for coming and speaking to us. We're very interested in hearing what you have to say, and you have a bit of a super fan here with Nuno, who's been following Burden of Command for, well, many, many years, Nuno. Is that right?
We announced only a week or two ago, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have to say a quick story on that, and then I'll let you continue. This is my self-flagellation moment in the podcast, the first one. So, God, I don't even want to say this, but I'll say it. In 2017, we announced ourselves, and please don't look at our first video in any detail at the end where it says we will release in 2018. I remember the conversation with the team, and I was pretty new to all this, and some of them had a little more experience than me, and they said, do not put the release date in a video. And I said, oh no, I know so well what I'm doing here. It can't possibly take longer than 2018. And so I always think of myself as a classic Green Lieutenant who is certain they know how to handle combat. Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted the flow there. Go ahead.
No, it's fine.
So I've been much more careful since then.
It's fine. So we are 7 years late.
Oh, filthy lies. That's fake news. Come on. I have to scrub that video. I'm sure AI can fix that for me.
Oh, keep it.
It's a lot of ambition. You know, we actually, another fib or mistake on our latest release video, we say 500,000 words. That's a filthy lie. It's actually probably about 700,000 or something, but we thought, 500,000 just sounds cooler. So there's actually more. So writing what amounts to about 6 novels of interactive fiction, and before everybody turns off the mic and says, I'm not playing that, you don't experience all that, of course. That's to give you a decision space of choices and reactions. That takes a little while. And then if you I want to learn how to build a game engine from scratch, I did it mostly in Python, that takes a little while, because in another brilliant decision of mine, it was very clear to me very early in development, pre-2017, when I was starting to poke at this thing, that, you know, Unreal couldn't really handle 2D. So that was one of my other really good decisions. I'm doing a great job here of pretty much ensuring nobody will want the game from the long series of mistakes, but maybe from a sense of pity, they'll try the game out. But more seriously, so a lot of fiction. We have about 70 to 80 hours of gameplay. We got voice actors in. That was all learning experiences. You would not believe, I should do a little video, the quantity of art drafts we tried to get to the art style we wanted with many different artists. You know, it's all a learning curve for me. And then the tactical work. And then honestly, outside of bugs and things like that, we've done a lot of playtesting. Now, I don't mean we've had millions of people pounding the game, but we got about 500, 600 people who we forced through a 20-minute questionnaire to sort of see if they were serious. And they came in, and we probably had in the end about 300 or 400 people tested at one stage or another, give us feedback. We would meet with them every week, talk to them, have them fill out surveys, survey monkeys and so forth, and act on that. And I would say that takes time, right? Mm-hmm. And it didn't get rid of all the bugs. I'm sure people are going to experience things, but it got awfully better than it was. And I will say another positively humbling experience, meaning my background, I worked as a director of research for a large firm, Accenture. I was very interested in what's called human-centered design, which is a fancy way to say good interface. And I thought, oh, for God's sake, surely I can do a good interface. I'm an expert. So, well, it was really interesting getting feedback early on. That was humbling. But after a zillion iterations, it seems pretty good on certain things. Like we have a chain of command. You know, there's a captain and there's a lieutenant report to them. Lieutenants are in charge of a platoon. A platoon has squads in it. And to display that information is non-trivial, because that's a lot of information mm-hmm. In the game as you play as a company commander. And to make clear, because you activate like a real organization, as a platoon, not as a single unit. You don't move one unit. You can move Thompson's platoon or Dearborn's platoon. I'm terrible here. I've chattered on. I haven't even explained what the damn game is. Damn game is a game on leadership. That's what if you want a second two words, it's a leadership RPG. If you want a longer word, you play an infantry company commander in World War II, and you follow the historic cotton balers, based on a book by the historian John McManus. So I'll shut up. I went on too long there, but you actually did point out some things I haven't been asked, so it was fun to talk about.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll have some other things that you haven't talked about yet, and let's kick off. So you mentioned there leadership RPG, and that's how you've described Burden of Command.
Yeah.
Which is entirely different to what people may expect as a traditional war game. But let me just ask on that point, how does strategy factor into a leadership RPG?
Well, I'm now suspicious of Al, says he just plays RTS games. That was a very nice question, because I mean well crafted, because we've had a problem, right? Which we feel we're doing something creative. There is no leadership RPG out there that we're aware of, and that's nice, right? It gets people's attention. It got us unusual attention early on, mm-hmm. but it's also a problem because people don't know what that is. So we've seen many places like sites, websites, and others who just characterize this as a war game. Now, there's truth there, right? We do draw on board game and, close combat style mechanics and a little bit of combat mission, all those kind of things. Absolutely, we draw on those traditions. On the other hand, we draw on traditions, you know, of like Shadowrun or name your favorite turn-based RPG. There's a lot of narrative interactive fiction very tied into the tactical. So, and then we do focus on leadership as a concept. What does it mean to be a leader? We do a little, I would call it, I'm still pissed at Disco Elysium, because they had their wonderful cabinet. What is it? Their thought cabinet? You know, what is your particular sort of style? Our lead writer, Alan Geese, who's a very successful Choice of Games writer, had the idea early on of what we call mindsets, which we thought of independently, I'll say at least. Are you going to be zealous? I wonder if anybody listening to the podcast can think of a lieutenant in Band of Brothers who was zealous. Very challenging. Who could that be? Or you can pick cautious or compassionate. So we did a lot of different things. And people don't know what to do with it, right? So they, like any human, like me, we slot it in something that is familiar. But it isn't familiar. And so when people do it, they're caught unexpected. If you want, I'll talk about, for instance, our tactical engine is unexpected, which caused us a lot of, I hope, positive problems in the long term. But yes, doing new things sounds very sexy and cool. But then when you confront the realities of it, it's sometimes very hard for people to grasp what the hell it is you're doing.
Do you think that might be because, since the game is mostly focused on leadership and also the tactics as well, but it clearly draws its main inspirations from things like the aspect of being a leader. Do you think it's very hard to transpire that into a video game? Because leadership is such an obscure, it's not an obscure concept, but it's so ethereal, right? And it's how can you make people understand this concept, especially people who never led teams, like be it at the work or on the military itself. Because, like, as someone who led teams in, or still does, at my workplace, I can see why some of the decisions were made, but I can also see why some people might be a bit scared by that. So I'm curious to know what were the
That's another very good question. I have a rule from a book I admire called When Friends Influence People, written in the 1920s, but still very valid. And the gist of it is try to listen honestly and speak positive truths to people. So if I say things like, I think, you know, you guys are asking questions, I'm not BSing you. Obviously, I'd like to be nice to you, but I do mean it. That is a good question. It is hard to say what leadership is. Well, I put a lot of Yeah, God, that's, I really enjoy these questions. This is fresh too. You'd think that one had been asked a lot. Okay, let me say first, I was always interested in leadership. You know, growing up, read a lot of military history books, Civil War, and so forth. Very interested in, you know, what was to be a military leader. Then I became very interested in political readers, a lot of biographies. Then I remember I went to Accenture and I became a young manager, and never been a manager. And I had read a lot on leadership because I wanted to be a good leader. And I was, as it seems to be in my life course, like most of us, I suppose, I got schooled. One thing I can tell you on leadership that makes it, as you say, complicated, and then I'll shift to what the game means, leadership, etc., is I assume naively that leadership, there is a way to lead, and you must do it well. For instance, there are principles. One principle in leadership is lead from the front, but sometimes that's not the right decision. One critique of Rommel as he rose to a level where he shouldn't have been leading to the from the front and became less effective. He was thought of excellent at a certain scale, but later it wasn't a good decision. Anyway, you think there are these general abstractions. So there I'm a young manager, and I'm trying to apply some principles, like I'll try to be at the office first, I'll lead by example, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'll manage a certain way. And I would say, humblingly, the most important thing I learned about leadership was every person's different. You treat them differently, and they differ in different management. Some people need a lot of explicit direction. I remember, on the other hand, I remember a very capable manager got really pissed, or a person working for me got really pissed at me because I was giving too much guidance. And there's a wonderful book out there. Now I'm transitioning to the military side, which is, I read a lot on this, called Battle Leadership. And it's by it's a really interesting story. A Marine major told me about this. It still was apparently being used at Quantico. It's by Captain Adolf von Schell. And he was a German who had fought in World War I. He came over and gave a talk at the Marine Academy. And then he went on and became a German Panzer Corps commander, I believe, in World War II. Very interesting man. Excellent book, not too long. Anyway, he said something similar. He said, here I am, he's describing World War I. He says, what I learned was I had to treat each of my subordinates differently. So I can't remember the names anymore. But one of his subordinates, he knew that he had to give very explicit guidance. You will go here. You will put your men in this position. You will hold here. The other guy knew he better not say much, or the guy would get pissy, like I described, right, and not do a good job. And the third one I always loved, he said, he knew with this guy, no matter what he said, the guy would try to do the opposite. So he would say, oh, I really think we should do a frontal assault. So the guy could say, oh, no, sir, I really think we have to flank, when his intent was to get the guy to flank. So there's a principle. So now how the hell do you put that into game? Well, first, there are some games that have done things. I exaggerate a little bit. Some of your listeners are going to know a board game called Squad Leader, right? And Squad Leader is explicit. Put the leaders on the board. Have them influence the fighting. Improve, give fire direction. Rally troops. So we draw on that tradition. And I can talk, if you want, about the evidence for where those are right or not. There's a wonderful other book called Brains and Bullets, now called War Games, by Dermot Rooney. And he really delves into, how do leaders influence morale? How do they get them to do something people are annoyed about in the game? Do an assault. Real soldiers don't want a bayonet in the stomach. So you need a leader, maybe leading by example at the front, to get them to do something very unpleasant, like assault people are firing at you. But then narratively, how do we get something like style? Right? Well, interactive fiction is marvelous. Because if we wanted, with four words, we could have aliens land. The aliens land, as Dearborn talks, right? Because words are incredibly powerful, as Nuno knows. So the fiction allows us to do anything. We don't have aliens landing, by the way, before anybody misquotes me. But we do worry about things like the different natures and styles of lieutenants. Trust me, your reports are different people in Burden of Command. You'll have to learn how to lead them. And then other things that Alan suggested, like the mindsets, right? What kind of leader will you be? Each of your lieutenants will develop a mindset. One of them, I'd have to go think who's who, will become cautious or zealous, et cetera, and how will you handle them? Which will you use in what situations? So leadership's very complicated in combat and in the game. It's about where do you put your leader? And then I'll give you one more concrete example because I don't want to just stay in these sort of abstractions. Let's make it mechanical and like the game. So here I am. I'm playing Burden of Command. There's a squad on the map, member of my platoon. Actually, there's my platoon. And I'm trying to figure out an assault. Now, in the game, we do unusual tactics. which is the four Fs, meaning find, fix, flank, and finish. To translate, that means fire to suppress. When you've got them suppressed, which is a fancy way to say, hey, they're keeping their heads down because they don't want to die and they're not shooting at you, then somebody assault. So, now, Al, I mean, what are you going to do here, Al or Nuna? Are you going to put your leader with a machine gun, like squad leader, to make the machine gun suppress the enemy better? But then you're not leading the assault. Well, maybe you should put him with the squad to lead the assault. But then you're not directing a fire, so the suppression might not be as good. And maybe you're just being superhero, and you're leading so many assaults, you're going to be dead pretty soon. And then that's not going to be too good for morale. So, you know, we try to put you in tough decisions. We try to put you in attentional issues as a leader, which is, you'd love to do everything. But one of the problems in the battlefield is there's a lot going on. It's hard to keep up, and it's hard to manage it all. And everything's happening in parallel. So we give you a few orders, what games might call action points. How do you spend those? Should you spend them on bolstering your troops before the assault? Should you spend them on guiding that fire? Should you spend one of your few orders to run over and help that squad who's suppressed? We're trying to always give you... My evil game design principle was always give you less capacity than you want. So you're doing what Sid Meier would call an interesting decision. God damn it, which ones do I do here? If you're thinking that way, I feel like I've done my job, and you're learning what it is to be a leader. In other words, it sucks a bit.
Yeah, you mentioned something that's rather interesting. Shows how different the game is from traditional war games, because in most war games, officer units tend to feel like something secondary, so you don't need them to win the battle. You don't like they're a buff, right? They're a walking buff most of the time.
Walking buff, good term.
Yeah, so in Burden of Command, it's exactly the opposite. Like, so you are like I played the game like a couple of months ago, and units, while having an officer with them, were much more effective. So they the game is actually built around them, right? So at least it felt to me like that way.
Well, that's not chance. So I will say, you know, I spent a lot of time in innovation and Silicon Valley and things like. I work pretty hard on a principle they use in Silicon Valley, which is you got to be able to do an elevator pitch. So even though I'm talking a fair bit, I do know how to do elevator pitch. Like you asked me what the game's about, I can give you one word, leadership, right? And I did that early. I can give you a phrase, leadership RPG, etc. So my point is you learn, that's one principle. Another principle, and I did a lot of background reading on how to be a game designer, because I'd never been a game designer except, you know, a little fun on the side. I did D&D campaigns and things like that. I did a lot of reading on that. And you'd really, according to the good books I read, you know, you really need to know what the central point of your game is and then drive it home everywhere. So I worked really hard to get to that elevator message, leadership. And then I worked as hard as I could with the team to drive that home on every front. So it's not chance we have beautiful portraits of leaders, because leaders are about, you know, you want to know these people, the human face of battle you're leading. You want... What's a leader on the battlefield? All the things I just described, right? That command and control issue. In the military, it's explicit also. You're not leading anybody you point at. Many games will say, oh, you know, whatever squad's nearby, I can take control of it. That's not the way it really works, right? You control your platoon, typically. So we try to reflect that. So the music. So let me explain one central design principle around the leadership and then how we like realizing the music. So... We spend a lot of time as a team thinking about what the hell is the burden of command? Nice phrase. Really, what is it? And we came to the insight that there is a central tension in this leadership issue of, burden of command, which is men versus mission. Are you going to send your men up this hill? On an ethical level, are you going to get people killed for this hill? Are you going to get Dearborn killed in 1945 near the end of the war when he's been faithful service to take one more goddamn hill? But on the other hand, war maybe demands it. On the other hand, people may remember Band of Brothers. Winters at a certain point, when he's ordered once more to go over the canal to capture, rather pointlessly, late war, arguably more information to risk his men, though he was an honorable Quaker-like guy, you know, he lied and said, he did send him again. He was favoring men. So we're putting in that principle, men versus mission. In fact, a late insight we had, I'm pretty proud of, is, I don't know if any of our game does this, is we explicitly articulate two forms of victory. mission, which every gamer knows, right? Take the hill, take the objective, kill the bad guys. But we also have men. How many casualties have you lost? And so we're trying to put you in this tension for this scenario. Well, I could. I'm a gamer. I'd love to take that extra objective. But I'm getting near the edge of the my casualty rate to only get a minor victory or a draw in the men condition to give the gamer everybody wants to win, but you need to win with the men too. And then we reinforce it narratively. So you had a brilliant victory. You took the hill. You're so impressive. Wow, Patton will learn from you. But when you get, then Grant comes by, the sergeant, your lead sergeant, and he has some things to say to you about how the men are feeling right now, since many of them are dead for your glory. Inversely, suppose you're cautious, you're a bleeding heart, you take good care of your men, you don't want anybody to die, so you don't take the hill. Well, we will put you in visits to the colonel's tent. And fun story, we had a playtester, I won't name him just to be kind, but you know, we were doing live playtests, and he said, well, he was a very cautious guy. That was his mindset. I don't really want to take this hill. I don't think I'll do that. And we said, okay, well, you know, you will have to visit the colonel's tent. And we talked a little bit about that. And he said, well, you know, maybe I will try to take this hill. So my point here, music. I said, how in the music? So in the music, Chris Scribner did a fantastic job, in my opinion, many others, of the music. He explicitly puts in a men theme. We have a men theme, a mission theme, and then a mix of those, just like in reality. So why are the portraits appealing? It's nice, right? But there's a reason behind it, which is to make you bond artistically with the men so that you feel the men. Why do we write 700,000 words? Why is it? So you know these people. You know their past. You know you care about them as individuals. If we just said, oh, look, it's really cool, they're 200... people, 100 people in your company, and hear all their names, that'd be nice, but you wouldn't bond, and you'd send them up the hill. So what I'm driving at is, across the design, all the elements, always thinking, what is leadership? How do you express it narratively? How do you express it artistically? How do you express it musically? How do you express it tactically? Now, I don't know that we did all those things successfully, but we tried, and we focused, and we explicitly tried not to get distracted by other principles.
On that point then, because there's an interesting thing you mentioned there, which is the decision between the mission or the men. Yeah. And if I take our listeners back in time to when we did episode 8, so when we were very new, episode 8 was about morals in strategy and wargaming. And I'm interested...
I listened to that. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
So I'm interested to know how you approach morals, ethics, and specifically empathy in this game, because... you're going to care about your guys, won't you?
Well, another good question. Yes, you know, games I admire. Well, there are many games I enjoy, and I don't always need deep games. Trust me, I like to play quote unquote stupid games like everybody else too. But when I'm thinking about more morally deep games, games like This War of Mine, are very impressive to my view. It was an influence on me early on. So those of you listeners who don't know, highly recommended, highly successful game, 8-10 years ago. And the gist of it is, you're an equivalent of Sarajevo, you're a civilian. What was its slogan? It was something like, in war, not everyone's a soldier. It's very clever. It starts with, oh, super soldiers, and then it transitions to that, and you're like, wow, everybody isn't. So you're a civilian in a war-torn Sarajevo, and you're trying to survive. With a few colleagues and other civilians, you're learning their backstory. So I remember I played a game, and I went to the front door metaphorically in the game because somebody knocked, and there were some little children, and they said, oh, we're really in desperate shape, or our mother's ill, I think they said, and do you have any medicine to spare? So I'm a nice guy, I'm a good guy, right? I give them some medicine. I turn around very proud of myself. I've been a moral guy. Oh, and it was so, so brilliant. Like the voiceover comes from one of the other members of my group, and they said, what the hell are you doing? John or Sue, whoever it was, is lying in the back room deadly ill, and you just gave our medicine to these children. Now, there's a strong ethical argument to why to give the medicine to the children, mm-hmm. but there's also a strong argument for the other case, right? And day to day, we all face, well, I hope not, but things in the spirit we see or the world faces, how do we spend our resources? So those are hard decisions. And going back a little bit to game designer mode, like Sid Meier, said, you know, we want interesting decisions. I think interesting decisions can also be ethical. Another the game designer, the guy who did another one like this. What's the game where you're in a like North Pole practically and you're trying to build a city?
Frostpunk.
And it's a city. Thank you, Frostpunk. The designer for that, who I'm proud to say falls a burden, he wrote something like, a very effective moment game design is you can create, what is it? It's like a game dissonance in the sense like you're sitting in, at one moment you're in a game, then the next moment you're thinking, I didn't give the medicine to those kids. What kind of person am I actually, Luke? You know, as a person in the real world, who am I? And he said, those are very powerful moments. And Frostpunk is devilish in its attempts to put you in those kind of situations.
Mm-hmm, it is.
And so what we want to do was say, Al or Nuno or you, listener, what will your leadership journey will be? Who are you, in fact, as a leader when the time comes? Are you so compassionate? But you were so compassionate that the other company on the other hill is now dying more because you didn't risk your men enough. Or you risked your men enough but now to save the other company, but now the men are like, who the hell do you care about, sir? You know, or looking at you that way if they don't dare to say it. And so gray decisions like those games I just described, I think, are often the reality of battle. There's a wonderful, wonderful speech that I post sometimes from the head of the 3rd Infantry Division, Truscott, who was a great general, and you're a member of the Cotton Bailers, 7th Regiment of the 3rd Infantry Division. And Truscott, there's this wonderful thing in Rick Atkinson's trilogy on World War II, which I really recommend. He turns around late war, and he looks at a graveyard that, what is it full of? All the soldiers who have died, U.S. soldiers who have died in the war. It's in Italy, the war's not over yet. And he says, I'm paraphrasing here, something like, all generals, you know, want to reassure, leaders want to reassure their men, you know, they've made the right decisions, and they're doing it well, because men would like to hear that, right? They'd like to believe that. But the truth is, we all make mistakes, and people die from our mistakes. Now imagine a man sitting there and owning the death of people who will not go back to their families, or their mothers, or their fathers. That's a terrible thing. So we put you in situations where we hope, not only through mechanics like mindset and tactical play and narrative decisions, you will come to some sense of, well, you thought you were a certain type of person, but when actually you were put in certain situations, maybe you're a different kind of person. Now, that doesn't have to be bad. Maybe you walk out of there and say, well, you know, I used to judge those soldiers or captains or whatever who made those decisions that I never would have made. But now that I've been in the boots on their ground, I made some similar decisions, and so I have some more, as you said, Al, empathy and compassion, not only for my virtual soldiers, but maybe for the real people who serve out in wars and military. And we have a lot of vets involved, and the reason we have a lot of vets involved is they came out of the woodwork when the game articulated itself, because they felt what I'm saying right now had not been said generally in games. War games in particular were, remember, we're not a war game, but we do draw. War games were either, typically for most people, first-person shooters, run around, extremely emotionally sound visuals. I played, you know, I'm a little tired now, end of the day, you know, name a first-person shooter, but, oh, Medal of Honor, right? You know, and it was very impressive, and I jumped off the landing craft, I'm like, oh my God, I feel like I'm in Saving Private Ryan. Man, I'm totally buying it until I die 20 seconds in, and 20 seconds later I respawn. Not quite as, you know, believing it now. I don't think there's much burden to command when, you know, everybody, you can respawn and also you can kill everybody sort of without much problem. Or you played sort of strategy war games at a distance. I'll move 3rd Panzer here. I'll move 3rd Infantry Division there. Great if you know the history. Otherwise, what the hell are you doing there, dude, when you're looking at the units? So in war, now there are exceptions, and I'm exaggerating, but my point is, you know, there's Hell Let Loose, and everyone's to do some very interesting, credible things. So I'm not slamming everybody. I'm just saying what is typical. And we did get vets, and they came because they felt we were telling a story and giving an understanding of war that had not been given typically. And I, again, saying the spirit of, like, Frostpunk or this war of mine, but on the combat experience.
Look, I would like to ask you, how do those veteran experiences influence your your game?
Yeah, I just have to stop saying interesting question. I'm going to just look like a total shill. I have to actually think about that for a moment. I just remember I had a conversation with a Marine officer who had been in combat in Iraq, and I remember being very effective. He told me, but I'm trying to struggle with bringing the conversation back. I think,
you're being challenged, yes, aren't you?
No, you really did a good job there. I don't usually get paused. I can usually BS with the best of them, but you got me there. I'll take some here. Okay, so we have a sergeant, a U.S. Army engineer sergeant, Steve Overton, and he took some principles, right? He has a principle. So one of the things he taught me was what I quote there. He said, you know, I consider the point of he's very into classic war games, and he's done board design, and he's also a famous designer from Combat Mission he's the Russian, I got to get his name, Mad Russian, that's right. He's the Mad Russian designer in Combat Mission. Some of you may know him. He had a principle like, if they're not screaming at the monitor when they're playing my scenario, then I failed as a designer. But he said, look, the point of, what you try to do in these games is you try to put them in their boots, you try to put the player in their boots on, the actual, let's just say, like winners' boots on winners' ground at the moment in time, and then you let them make their own decisions. So what he was trying to teach was put you in these military situations and the way you think about them. And then I think we also have, Henk Stoffer, who was in the Dutch Army, and he's a really knowledgeable on things like the MG42, the famous German machine gun, why it was so effective. He's fired that kind of weapon. And have personal kind of experience and suppression. So they could help me a lot on the tactical. I've been focused on the moral and ethical and all that. But also they were getting me focused on things like, you know, how to put down suppression, why it matters, what it really is to do effective fire and so forth. So a lot there. And then I would say they drew on some examples, but I'd have to think, you know, you'll have to come back to you on that, on particular cases they dealt with officers and so forth. They were very, I would say, very concerned to be respectful of the historic officers. So let me give an example of that. We had in John McManus's Cottonbailer's book, I don't want to get too accurate in this because then I'll be disrespectful, but there's a high-level officer historically makes a pretty questionable decision that puts a lot of men at risk and exposes them to fire. And in the real war, it led to a confrontation between one of his subordinates to him, and I think, you know, to the point that some, I forget which side got relieved, the superior officer or him, but that kind of confrontation. And, oh, and then I remember one more on this. I'll give a great example. I haven't used this example in a while. But anyway, we want to be very careful there, because who the hell are we to judge what that officer did? Maybe he knew more than a subordinate who was upset with him. So we established some principles in the narrative and so forth. Like, if we had anybody historical in it, we would not touch what they could have done and only do what they did do, right, for an historic character. Because who are we to say anything about what they should have said or what they would say? So that was sort of a principle they established. The other example I'd give, this is a historic one, that, you know, these are, I'll just use these third-party examples. So the Spears in Band of Brothers, you know, there's that situation where
he takes a guy for smokes.
What?
He gave smokes to some guys, right? Is that the situation?
Yeah, so I'm referring to that scene. Yes. So there's that. And then the other one he did is apparently before that, he was pulled up for court-martial, I believe, or something along those lines, or hearing, because he had shot a sergeant dead. Now, why'd you shoot that sergeant dead? Because, and I somebody can correct me later in details, but I think I have it roughly right. The sergeant, he had ordered not to advance, but then the sergeant got up and sort of waved the men forward, and he said, "Sergeant, something, stop," or whatever. And we, as an early example, Bird in Command, I blew this story a little bit, but let me do it like I should have done it. So, you turn and look at your sergeant. Your sergeant is moving the men forward. Do you order him to stop? he turns and looks at you blearily. You know, maybe he's drunk, maybe he's exhausted, you're not sure, and still orders the men forward. What do you do? I wish I hadn't blown this one, because it's such a good punch. Do you order him to stop again? Do you, you know, wave your rifle at him or whatever? Or, and there were a couple other very reasonable choices, and the other choice was shoot him. And without exception, everybody ever put in this situation, so I got to remember this next time, they never pick shoot him. And yet Spears picked shoot him. And he was absolved for doing that because the sergeant was putting two men at risk. Now, I don't think he was trying to kill the guy. I just shot him, but I think it came out badly. So my point is very real situations from real war. And, you know, how do you deal with them? And I'm using historical examples primarily. But what was very, very appealing was in our weekly design sessions was to talk to real veterans and get their advice on, you know, well, how do you frame that? And then constantly educating the writers, to be frank. We have very high-quality writers, both Paul and Alan, both Paul Wang and Alan Geese from Choice of Games background, very successful for that interactive fiction. But they know some things about the military. Paul knows a lot about 18th century warfare, and Alan had written some excellent World War II Choice of Games. But they don't know things like Hank and Steve do, right? And others like Adam, I alluded to, many other vets. And so they were constantly getting educated in a pleasant way, you know, on how things work, what the realities are, and how it does work in the military as opposed to how we might fantasize. So did we get it all right? Of course not. But do we often say more of what the realities are? Yeah. For instance, we have, for God's sake, we have a letter writing section where you have to write letters home. Or you have to deal with logistics. I will say one of the most emotionally intense, weirdly enough, situations for me personally was the writer with some advice from the vets put me through around logistics. I can tell that story if you don't believe I can make logistics interesting emotionally. But anyway, I don't want to keep going. So, yeah, I mean, the vets, I would say, are pervasive. One reason I can't just instantly pop out examples all the way through. No, that's the way the weaponry works. No, that's the issue with this tank. No, actually, this is the way they command. No, that's what the sergeant does. He knows there are a lot of no's. A lot of educating. And they're both very red, too, especially Steve Overton has a huge library in World War II.
So the example you mentioned there of Spears and the sergeant, I saw that scenario mm-hmm. when I was doing some research before we had this
good.
Interview.
You should have stopped me before I blew the punchline.
No.
Good.
And my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that your response either influences or is influenced by the mindset of the leader. Is that correct? And if so, can you just explain these mindsets
Very
work?
Good. Thank you. I'm glad you're here, man. Okay. So what happens is, so what are these mindsets? I alluded to them, like zealous, right? Spears or cautious, etc. We put them on, there's a circle of mindsets. Because guess what? If you're zealous, you're probably not cautious, right? So they're on the opposite ends of the circle. How does that matter? Well, you can't be everywhere at once. So if you picked a zealous character, but now, how do gamers play games, right? I play it the same way. I min-max all the time, right? If you're a mastery player. And actually, I want to talk in a moment about what we learned from playtesters, different types of players. I'm a min-maxer a bit. I like, it's called mastery. I like to win the game. Others are role players. They really want to be in the moment and make bad decisions necessarily. So I'll talk about that in a moment. But, so, okay, so you know the right decision here as a min-max gamer. Oh, I'll pick the cautious choice, or the zealous, that's going to be more credible. Oh, I know they're going to give me a big reward if I'm brave ass here and I do something unexpected. I'll pick the zealous shooting choice, and I know I'll get bonuses. Well, what we do is, oh, you want to violate your mindset. You're a cautious person, and you want to be zealous now. Oh, well, you know, people don't do that too easily. We'll let you do it, but we're going to stress you. Right? Because that would be stressful to try to be a different person than you are. So we make it, you pay a price. Nor can you like, well, I want to do the optimally designed super character. I will have some of everything. Well, if you start to invest to get a bonus, right, in zealous, you have to invest repeated mindset points that you only get narrative moments, unusually, rather than strictly, you know, tactical moments, though they can be narratively driven. So you build up your zealous mindset. Well, now, buying outside of your sort of space on the wheel of what's natural for you gets expensive. Oh, well, you thought you wanted to be zealous, but you want to be cautious. Okay, well, you're going to have to pay extra. In other words, we're trying to make it, Always the same principle again. You don't get everything. Oh, you want to be zealous or you're not cautious? Oh, you want, and now we try not to restrict your action. You want to be, pick a cautious choice? Okay. But if it's unnatural, you'll regret it. And then before I forget that, so thank you for bringing that up. And we put you through things called crucibles, which are particularly difficult moral situations where you must decide what mindset you will be, right? So the, how do you ever pick a zealous or cautious? You're going to have some difficult situations, often drawn from history, rather than just being clever. Because history is brings up really weird things like the spear story. Who would believe that was true? And yet it is. So we put you in these crucibles. That first choice you make, Al, that's going to be investing in a mindset. You're starting to define yourself. Do you, you'd love the bonus or whatever the hell for the cautious choice. Well, okay, go for it. But then guess what? You're a cautious guy. So that's, as a player, you're going to roll, you're going to be influenced on the, and we, I think we do sometimes only give you some choices that are based on your mindset, but I'd have to get Alan in here. But normally it's sort of this cost benefit, what you choose to be. Now, before I stop on that, I want to shift to one thing that's really interesting. So playtest, people are different. Remember that leadership principle? Oh my God, people are different. So there's a wonderful company out there, Quandary Foundry, that has had like 600,000 surveys of players. And I encourage people to go take their survey. It's free. And you find out who you are. Like I lean towards mastery, like I described. That's one of the types. Another archetype, though, is role playing. Another one is, what's it called? Creative. Creative means they just love to break the game. They're going to do anything they can to, you know, like get to beat the game with riding a bike upside down or whatever. And I'm blanking on the last type. But role players are really interesting. So role player really puts being in the world first over, I think these like the people play Crusader Kings, you know, 3, and they write their epic logs of who they were as a king or queen or whatever. Role players put that first over mastery, tactical. It's just alien to me. I did run into one of these people playing D&D at a convention once. So I'm at the convention, we're all outside the door where we think the monsters are there, and we're figuring out the optimal strategy. Well, we will listen carefully. We will get our spells. We will bless each other. We will then open the door and massacre him. So this guy, who's a role player, he just burst the door open because he was playing a drunken, kind of drunken vet or something. He just ran into a fighter, and we just ran in, and we're like, what the? Well, I'll try to be polite in my language. What the? You know what I'm thinking. And total chaos ensued because we weren't ready. And I have to say, one of the more memorable fights I was ever in, because he put us in a, he role played what his character was like, and it created such story and drama. So we have a large portion of people who want to play the game who are not war gamers or mastery or tactician. They wanted to role play and immerse and try to be zealous or cautious and carry that all the way through. And so we work pretty hard in the design to try to support that, right? That you can be a certain type of person. You can prioritize men victory conditions over mission victory conditions and find out who you are on and off the battlefield. And I will push that point again. Off the battlefield, too. French collaborators, mm-hmm. logistics issues, letters home, visits to Rome, not battle. It is not a war game, though it involves in war game. You use war game tactics. It's also a role-playing game. That, you know, you go to a dinner with an Italian family in Naples, and I won't spoil it for you, but it's particularly interesting. Let's just put it that way. I don't think that's really a squad leader, is it? Or combat mission.
But it fits the RPG nature of the game. And I think it's people, yes. And I guess what we need to do is get people out of the mindset that this is a war game, because it looks like a war game when you, yes. when you first look at it, the
first in the map,
it's a hex, it's military yeah. units. People are going to think this is a war game, yeah. but it isn't. There's a distinction. And it's interesting on these mindsets, because another really interesting thing that I thought when I loaded up the demo recently and started a new campaign was the leadership characteristics of sarcasm, verbosity, directness. And completely different to what you would normally expect to see in an RPG, where you could have bravery, discipline, agility, mm-hmm. The kind of things you'd see in Dungeons & Dragons. What was the thought process behind using these different leadership characteristics over what would be traditional ones?
I thought a characteristic was, thank God I hired people who know more than me. What I mean by that is, you know, I brought in professional writers who had spent a lot of time creating decision spaces and choice of games, right? And so they knew things like this. They knew to just sort of define your style by how you wrote and so forth. So I would never have thought of that. We brought in people like I alluded to, Stephen Hank, who, you know, had spent a lot of time on combat mission scenarios, things like that, and knew much. I know a lot of wargaming, but know a lot more than me on that. So I would say things like that came in also from the variety of people we brought in. And that led to problems early on, in the sense that the wargame designers had never worked with writers. The writers had never worked with wargame designers. So that took time for us to figure out, you know, what's a battle? Look, shockingly, the wargame designers thought it should be about the maneuver on the map and the forces deployed. Shockingly, the writer thought it should be about the decisions that are made emotionally and morally, and, you know, and also just a distant what resource we're going to bring in. And so very different ways of looking at the world of combat. And yet, and at times early on, I would say it led to some, you know, rather intense arguments. And is this right for me, this project? But eventually, I think we just had a playtester go through, and his feedback was, I'm going to toot my horn here, but I'm really tooting the team's horn. So his feedback was, one, the writing, he thought the characters are more interesting than most AAA titles he'd played. So I'll give Alan Paul choice. I can give you the text in this. I'm not making this up. He said the tactical game he felt was in its own right a good tactical game, whereas he loved Shadowrun, for example, like I do too. But, you know, the tactical, great narrative, tactical, okay. But he thought that's great. But then he thought, this is the most gratifying on this point, the integration of the tactical and the narrative was very strong. He felt like his decisions in the narrative influenced the battle, and they certainly do, by the way. Or inversely, the things he did in the battle influenced narrative. Events pop because of what you do. And so that was hard to achieve, though, as a team. Very hard. Now we have it today. We know how to work with each other. The scenario designers think like the writers a bit. The writers think a bit like the tactical designers. But it was not easy getting to things like, oh, they want to do sarcasm? Why are they wasting time on sarcasm? They should be spending all their time on making sure the tanks have the right armor thickness so we can get this battle right. But if you read books on war, you know, accounts, oh, there are a lot of human factors, not just the table equipment. And fun little fact. So I got the privilege a few days ago talking with James Holland, the noted historian Al Murray, on We Have Ways of Making Talk podcast. And James Holland wrote a book called Band of Brothers in Arms. Falls kind of like Band of Brothers, a armor company. And I really learned some interesting things there on this sort of psychology, human factor. We all love tanks. They should have this thickness and the angle slope. Aren't the Germans brilliant with this sloped armor and really, you know, nerdy, cool things? But how did the American Shermans, which were lesser tanks on a one-to-one basis than the Tigers, German Tigers, beat the Tigers? Well, according to his book, it's fascinating. They had a higher rate of fire. Sometimes they were clever and flanked and hit the armor from the right side. But what they often did was they pounded the Tiger repeatedly with shots. And the crew freaked out in the Tiger tank, right? Like, we're going to die here because I keep hearing shells hitting me. I'm not staying here. And they'd either retreat, but often they'd bail out of the tank, right? Because they don't want to die. So now that's not armor slope. That's human factors on the battlefield. So you can imagine you might need writers to convey some of those moments, right? And I hope someday we'll put you in sort of fury-like inside a tank with your men and while still being an officer and deal with situations like the men are panicking and want to bail. Are you going to draw your pistol? What are you going to do? We have some moments like that, by the way, again, drawn from history, where you're going to decide, like our Spears example, how much are you willing to use force or not in this situation?
So, look, I have a university professor that had he wrote an amazing line on a book. He's a medievalist, so he wrote about medieval warfare. And when he was reflecting about how people face how people look back at history and how judgy they tend to be or how judgmental usually they are. He had this amazing line where he said, history doesn't care, which I think is just lovely because it's true. So what happened, happened. And what I would like to ask you is, how did you keep true to history in Bogdanov Command during the development, and how, because I know you did an amazing job, like you and your team, of course, did a fantastic job of restoring pictures, of bringing accounts back to life, and that's a level of love that you didn't have to do that to sell your game, right? So it's something that you guys did, and which is fantastic, and I think it's a public service as well. So I'm curious to know how did this all came to be. So how are you going to intertwine history in Bogdanov Command, and how are you going to respect it and also allow players to have freedom and to
interesting question. So first, it's very important to I'd say everybody in teams. It's very important to get the history right. They really care passionately about it. So for instance, we have a former naval officer, Steve Lohr, who runs our historical media team. It's all volunteers. They've done 1,500 historical photographs in the game. I think it's more than that now. It's a lot of work. Photo editing, colorizing, getting it right. Like, what the hell is the proper color of this uniform, you know, actually? Because people care about that kind of thing, because authenticity. So they care. And Steve's on the project in good part because he wants to tell the truth in, you know, whatever that means, about those who have served in the past. And so we're motivated by that, right? To try to get at some sense of what history was. Now, it's an unanswerable question, right? And it's all how you frame it and all that. Nonetheless, there are some things we can be objective about. What did they look like? What did they say? Insofar as I can. My dad was a professional historian and World War II vet. Now, I trot that line out, you know, but it's true. He really was. He cared about history. You know, he really did. And so I internalized that. I care a lot about trying to get the history right. And to me, I'm not a young man anymore. So the older I get, the more I connect to the past. Meaning, at my age, my dad, when I was in World War II, he saw U.S. Civil War veterans on the porch. Now think what a chasm it seems to most of us. Civil War did to me. But now I'm older now. I'm probably starting to be weird to people, right? I knew a World War II guy, my dad. Most people say, oh, you know, my grandfather. So history isn't as distant for me as I get older, just speaking as a person. But also, as you spend time immersed in the history, and, you know, excellent historians like, I hope, my dad, and Al Murray just wrote a book on Arnhem Black Tuesday about the paratroopers at Bridge Too Far. He's very clever. He tries to put you in their boots on the day when they thought they were going to win the war, and then by the end of the day, they thought they, like, how the hell they were going to hold on. And he tries to give you a sense of they don't know what's going on, and the radios are broken, and they're trying to guess, right? And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make you connect the people who were as alive as Al and Nuno and me, right, in their time. Oh, there's amazing photos that I saw a week or two ago on the internet now. I just stumbled across these. Oh, my God. They take black and white Napoleonic photos of soldiers. And the bastards, forgive my French, they stand up and they move around and they're colorized because the AI can do it with a 3D. And they come alive. And cowboys from old photos. It's really surreal. But my point is, they were real, like you and me. And so, to me, it's almost a spiritual mission to try, like Steve Lohr, I gave example, to connect to these people. They were alive. They gave their lives. They weren't an abstraction to themselves when they put their life on the line in 1942 or 1918 says it's a good day to die. So that connection, here another illustration in terms of the game. So I remember staring at this black, and the writers had been working me over early on in the project through all the fiction for it. Now, we'd been playing a game as an interactive of fiction because we didn't have all the tactical engine going. And I had to worry about the food from the men and the housing and the morale and made battle decisions, all kinds of interesting things. And, you know, with particular individuals, Dearborn and Thompson and so forth. Anyway, I was just looking at this black and white photo. And it's just a guy in the winter. I think he was in the Vosges Mountains, southern France. We go to weird places like southern France, not Normandy, because that's where the cotton balers went. And he's in the woods, and it's cold. And I just read a fiction thing from that. That's why I was looking at that photo. And I felt a connection to that guy I never had. Because writers had put me through situations where I had to worry about the cold, and I had read very concrete descriptions of, you know, what the cold's like. We had a very sophisticated writer, William Bernhardt, who writes legal thrillers. He sold 20 million copies. He's very sophisticated. He loves to teach writing. He came and advised us early on in writing. And the writers are good, but of course we learn things from a guy like that. And he said, you know, emphasize the concrete. Give the smell of the vomit at the bottom of the landing craft that the soldiers are in, right? Try to make it visceral. So the writers have been making it visceral to me, the cold, the misery. Because, oh yeah, it's all very dramatic in games. You're power tripping, you're shooting everybody dead. You're just a superhero. But practice, it's pretty nasty, and you're sleep deprived, and you don't have enough to eat, and you're scared, you know, that you're going to die. And first expelled soldiers are crapping their pants, and that's a normal physiological response, on and on and on. So anyway, I'd been reading all that, and I looked at this black and white photo, and I felt connected to him because of writing. Now, do I know his experience? Like, of course not. But I felt like the gap between me and the people in the past have been lessened. And so I feel that's a sacred mission in some sense, because we're all going to die, to try to connect to all these other people who have had their experiences in their day. You know, what were the 19th century people sitting in their lounges and talking about war? What did they say? Where someday people, if we're lucky, may glance at us 50 years from now and say, what were these guys talking about with this burden of command? What the hell was that? And what were they talking about with what we're talking about today? We've all lived. We've all been alive. Let's try to connect to those people. Now, you know, I'm saying all these grand things. I don't want to kid you. I want it to be a good game and interesting gameplay, but I do care about this. And Band of Brothers, somebody asked Tom Hanks, why do you bother with those weird helmets on those German paratroopers? Because he did have different kind of helmets. And he said, well, I don't know if people will notice it or not, but it felt really important to us to get it as it was. And I know that we have an actor from Band of Brothers, Shane Taylor, who does the medic episode, who did our voiceover for Sergeant Grant. And I've listened to some things about how they trained the actors for Band of Brothers. They put them through a boot camp. I think they took them something like the Philippines. And as much as they could, they had a tough, I think he's a Marine major, colonel, former, but he put them through a lot of pseudo boot camp. And they had to act like train like real soldiers did and get up early and have tough situations. And so why? So it could be feel as credible and be as credible in some sense as it is. And so Band of Brothers, I bring it up a lot because that's my Bible, right? It's respectful. It's emotionally intense. It says war is ugly at times and war is uplifting. You know, it's too simple-minded. Oh, war is terrible. Oh, it's so bad, killing. No, war sometimes is a time when people are at their best and give. It's like love. They give a sacrifice for their brothers, or their sisters, and these days, both. So, Band of Brothers, emotional, respectful, historically accurate, within reason, I mean, compared to usual, I think it does a pretty damn good job. Same guideline for us, right? We wanted to stay connected, and the vets weren't going to let us not. We had a fair number of arguments when we wanted to. We have a rule, bend but do not break history. So, you know, like early on, we say, oh, wouldn't it be cool to have some tigers come in? And the vets are like, no, or no, no vet tigers were in range, anywhere near, forget it. So, you know, and people want authenticity. I don't think it's chance that somebody doesn't want fun, of course. But why is Kingdom Come Deliverance 2 so successful? Obviously, it's probably outstanding as a game. But also, people feel, they smell, it's got a commitment to authenticity. And I think people care about that. So we have a commitment to authenticity. That doesn't mean we'll succeed, but we have a commitment.
So on that subject, Luke, and the person who said it will kill me for forgetting which one it was. It was one of our other co-hosts who said in one of our previous episodes, says that chasing realism can be a trap for game developers. And that really hit home because I thought, here, you've got a complex challenge of being real, but still making sure that people want to play Burden of Command. How do you make it still fun?
Oh, that's great. That's hard. Because people might be listening and saying, oh my God, I admire what they're trying to do here, but Jesus, I don't think I want to worry about all the things they seem to be implying they're worrying about. Well, look, I had a conscious idea of what the market I wanted to be for the game, for one thing. I wanted to reach a larger audience with history. That was a design goal. So, and I subconsciously started off with I wanted to be sort of XCOM World War II with some mix of some games I admired. It isn't, because being authentic forced us to do, I'd love to talk about this, tactics that are other than bang, 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 you're dead, because in World War II, well, I could get off on that speech. It's an interesting one. But my point is, realism comes at a cost. Actually, I can tell this story. Realism comes at a cost to gameplay in the short term. So I'll give you a very specific example. I challenge you to name a game, well, there are a few probably, a game where the solution in combat isn't to fire a lot until they're dead. Even, I like to reference it because it's kind of a more serious board game, The Squad Leader. Actually, that's a board game, tactical. What you really do, often you get a stack of doom, they're called, and you pound away at the unit with a lot of fire until it breaks. There's a morale idea, but then it breaks again and it's dead, routed, essentially. So, even the sober games, often, vast majority, bang, 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 you're dead. And gamers, but real combat, I read this book I alluded to, Brains and Bullets, War Games, Dermot Rooney advised us, real combat wasn't like that. Because when I'm going to challenge you with a really tough, complicated, emotional question here. You're standing upright, and I'm firing at you. What do?
I get on the floor.
Exactly. And if there's a wall, stone wall nearby, you get behind the goddamn wall, right? Because you don't want to die. So in practice, it's something like 40,000 bullets to kill somebody, realism, in World War II. So no, bang, 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 which everybody's trained on by games, including me, isn't truthful to World War II. So we stuck to that. But boy, we paid a short-term price because I cannot tell you how many people came in and try the demo. Right, if you sit there and bang, bang, bang away and you fire your machine guns and so forth, the enemy squads don't die. Slowly they do, but slowly. Right, 40,000 bullets for a casualty, and that's not even a kill. Because the other poor bastards don't want to die, so they're down behind a wall or in the little micro terrain, you know, this little where the land dips. It's hard to kill people when they do that. Battle of Fredericksburg and Civil War, they were lying, the Union soldiers were lying on the war till on the hill, where they've been slaughtered trying to get up to the hilltop till nightfall, and they survive because it's hard to kill people when they're down, just lying flat against the earth. And then they got away. So realism made us do the four Fs because we just, it's too much a violation of authenticity for what we're trying to do to not reflect that. When I'd read the book and I talked to, Rooney, I just couldn't sit here and not do it somewhat critically. But the cost, oh my God, the cost. So I want to get back to that. So we'd bring people in playtest, and they'd fire and fire and fire and fire, and they'd start to get frustrated because the units weren't dying, right? And so we started, the tutorial did text. Oh, you know, look, 4Fs, you know, 40,000 bullets, all that wonderful stuff. So it helped. Some percentage started to get that. A large percentage didn't. So now I started to learn that people learn different ways, right? They learn through text, they learn through pictures, they learn through experimentation, so forth. So we started doing diagrams, I think, about it, you know, just teaching that. Then one point the writers, and that's in the game too, we kept getting some more percentages of people were learning how to do the 4Fs each time we did one more way to batter at you in a different sort of medium in a tutorial. Finally, like the writer would start doing things like, Sergeant Grant would pop up, we detected in the engine, say, "Sir, they seem to be highly suppressed and cowering over there. Do you think we should assault?" And still some people would not. Now, that's not saying, oh, people dumb, oh, not assault. It's human nature. When you've been endlessly trained to behave a certain way, right? I mean, it's called conditioning, right? We're all conditioned. It's really hard to overcome a reflex. It's unconscious. And so some people wanted to go in and mess around a game, but if they did, they got frustrated because it worked differently. So now there's an example, Al, of the cost. It cost us. We will not have as large a market as we could have if we'd done World War II XCOM. But on the other hand, if you want credible, authentic, we'll be more. Now, you keep going down this route, you're going to kill your game. People will be very impressed and not want to play it, right? So we had to make decisions. So it's infinite the things we could have done. Like, we could do fatigue. We could do ammo limits, right? We could do how many bullets or how many shells the tank have. I mean, what about, there's so many things that happen on the battlefield. Remember we were talking earlier about what is history? How do you reflect history? Well, human experience is so complex. The battlefield is so complex. We can't. So what do? Going back to very early in the conversation, I just sat there constantly trying to use a scalpel, I hope, say, what am I cutting? Because all the game designers who are good say, cut. And I was always thinking, cut, because that's not a leadership point. Bullets aren't really the leadership point. Cut it. You know, supplies, cut it. Now, we were able to have our cake and eat a little bit, too, because the writers can do so much. When you land in Morocco, minor spoiler, Americans didn't know what they were doing. You won't have enough supplies as you start to head towards Casablanca. Now, we have no supply system modeled in the game, really. Go Unity at Command. They took a risk, and that was important to them for what they wanted to do. We don't do that. But the writers save our ass. So the writers give you descriptions of how supply limited you are and tell us a little what's going on, you know, and your lieutenants report to you. And then we apply some starting suppression to all your men, right? So the game, we just use a suppression mechanic. Oh, well, guess what? Everybody's starting a little off because they all don't have enough bullets. But we didn't model bullets. So, and then finally, you know, playtesting is God, right? You just, the playtesting, you listen. We did a lot of live playtesting. We had the surveys. Then you hear what's frustrating for people or confusing. And we've lost a lot of mechanics. I had a mechanic I was very proud of. What was it called? Friction. Because a battle has friction, right? Things start to break down. People get confused. There's fog of war. So I had this wonderful friction mechanic. Oh, you can press your troops. Press is still in the game. You can get an extra order, action point. And I thought, well, let's be a good designer. Let's make a negative. If you press them, I'm going to apply a point of friction, right? You can do a little extra. You can push them in. But they will now actually have lower morale because they're hurt sort of by what you did to them. And at some point, you're going to have to, you know, do some burdensome stuff to clear the friction. Players hated it because people hate, you know, negatives, right? This is really known in games now if you read the literature, right? People just do not like, oh, you know, we're going to have you take breaks from the game, so we're going to punish you by you can't play the game if you played it too long. I think there's some story like this. People hate that kind of crap. I mean, humans are not good at responding punishment, you know. Well, they will respond. They don't like it. So I did the opposite eventually. I gave you a reward. There's no consequence, really. You just use it up when you press. But it's actually sort of the same effect. You only get to press once until you do a rest. But you aren't punished. You just don't get to do it again. Which, when you go back and you do the mechanical modeling, it's not that different. One other quick, fun one. Realism. You know, maybe the further away they are from you, harder to command. Some games do that. I think it's a sensible mechanic. There's surely truth to that. I dropped it. Strangely enough, you can order men 30 hexes away in a map. Not realistic, right? Well, you can argue a little bit for radio. Well, how could I solve that without new rules and more complexity? Reward. So what I do is, okay, you want to take your platoon and put the three squads in different places in the map? Go for it. Guess what? You can't make them very effective. Your leader cannot be 20 hexes up north and 20 hexes down south at the same time. Unless he wants to run back and forth and run back and forth. And that's stupid. So I don't punish you, but I make the nature of the mechanics reward you for keeping your platoon together. So they're tricks of the trade. And I don't claim I thought of them, but I did study them pretty hard. And tricks of the trade like that, right? Don't make it a rule if you can avoid it. Sort of just naturally try to encourage that element. But it's super important to limit the realism. We have another principle, bend but do not break history, right? So we will stretch the truth sometimes because it's just too complex otherwise for the player and detracts from the experience, but we won't break it, right? We won't put tigers in North Africa in 1940, right? Or something crazy. I wasn't even fighting in 1940. So no jet fighters in North Africa, right? So, but there are limits, but it's always a tension. should we add that element of realism? Should we take it out? And every time we did something significant that deviated from people's experience, we paid a price. When we introduced the four F's and enforce them, it took a lot of energy and work and tutorializing, and we lost people from it because they didn't want to learn a new mechanic. That's fine. They're not required to learn a new mechanic. But we felt a commitment to it, but it's a cost. That's why our trailer, I hope people go watch the trailer. It's cute. It's three reasons not to buy Burden of Command, but it's also honest. So one of them is mature themes, right? There are some pretty dark things in there, but drawn from history. And most people think they want mature themes. I think it is interesting. Games like Frostpunk do it. But I remember there was a guy recently on one of the YouTubes about the game, and he said, these guys at Burden Command seem to revel in, you know, ugly and violence or something. So I came back, my high horse, so to speak, thinking, oh, well, look, he'll get it when I explain it to him. You know, we have a lot of vets on the team, and we think we should do things like that. It's important. And he came back to me and said, I was a sergeant major, I think, in Iraq, and I saw plenty of violence, and I want my war games to be fun. And what the hell could I say back to that guy? So all I could say, what I think I said was, I hear you. I'm listening hard, or I hear well, or something like that. Because who am I to speak? He spoke his truth, and that is truth. So, but other vets feel differently. And we have combat vets on the team who feel differently. So my point is, there's one truth, mature themes. Another one is, not by chance, you must learn authentic tactics. I just gave you a long spiel on that. Authentic tactics come at a cost. It may not be for everybody. I love XCOM, by the way. I want to play games with bang, 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 you're dead. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying it's not what we wanted to do for us. So if you don't want to learn that, and it is a little learning curve, probably Burden isn't for you. But I will say, people get through it. You know, they're really interested in it. And it becomes natural, but it's a learning curve. And what was the last one? Oh, yeah, you know, half a million words of interactive fiction. There's a lot of reading in the game. Not crazy, but a lot of reading. On the other hand, how else can we convey emotional states and strange situations like, you know, going into Naples? I don't have, I wish I had the budget of Baldur's Gate 3. Then maybe I could do with all beautiful 3D models and wonderful emotional voice acting for every single part, and maybe we'll be there someday. But they didn't get rid of words either, right? So there are a lot of words in there too. So, but that doesn't mean it's a game for you. So, sum up, Al, yeah, realism comes at a cost, but people want it too, right? The people who come to Burden will want some authenticity, but not too much. And I don't want there to be too much either, because then at some point I will just go read the history book, because why am I playing this game if it's just all the details? Let's just go read the book.
So it's finding that sweet spot, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Very hard. The only way I can say to answer it is the playtesting helps. Right, because if you listen hard and you have them rate things, you find out what's working or not, despite whatever you thought would work. So, and then sometimes though you make decisions like, no, yeah, people have a hard time with the four F's, but we're still going to do it because it's the right thing to do. So, you know, but that's a tough decision too.
Okay, I want to talk about the morale system, because this is really the core of the game.
That's right,
isn't it? In terms of influences the effectiveness of your units. Can you?
Yep.
Tell me about your thinking behind using this mechanic, because it's completely different to a traditional war game. And I know this is a leadership RPG, but please.
Well, we emphasize again, right? Not bullets and kill. Well, obviously, bullets do kill. And by the way, I overstay that. Like, artillery is pretty effective, relatively speaking, at killing, coming in at an angle and so forth. And artillery is more effective than Burden killing. But anyway, morale. People are on the battlefield. Think about yourself. I asked Al how he behaves a shot at. People behave that way. Right? So the battlefield's very psychological. Maybe it's going to change with the drones, but right now it's very psychological. And you know, if you read ancient battles, whole armies would break when they saw, you know, oh, the elite guard, you know, the Persian guards breaking, I'm breaking. and there's still lots of truth to that. Really neat example of how strange it can be, and then I'll try to get into core mechanics. So in War Games, the Brains and Bullets book, now War Games, he calls it weapons push and weapon pull. So let me put it in sort of gamer terms first. Guess what? When the enemy suddenly shows up on a dragon, you reassess how you feel about fighting out this battle. Maybe I'll come back another day to help the kingdom, whatever. Same on a real battlefield. You're sitting there, and the enemy suddenly has tanks, and you don't. Morale effect. So we have that in the game. It's shock, right? You actually lose more. Everybody can see that the Germans just showed up with a Panther, and you don't have any tanks. Take shock. They probably should, right? I mean, my God, it's not looking good. A really dramatic example of that. The British late war learned to parade flame tanks, flamethrower tanks, in front of Germans. So what, amazing story. So German hardened paratroopers, tough troops, are in a fortified village. They're gonna fight hard. People are gonna die. The British parade a flame tank in front of them, shooting a flame. Just parade it around, shooting the flame out. A little while later, white flags start popping up on the hardened paratroopers. They are tough guys, by the way. Because, you know, late war, I don't know that I really want to die by flame now that I see it. So now those are dramatic stories. Mechanics. So every unit, so it starts 10 morale. If it's well-trained, American, say German. But say the Vichy Italians do not start that way because they didn't want to fight for various reasons at this stage of the war, with exceptions and so forth. And painting broad strokes here. So they might cite 6 to 7 morale. What does that mean? Very simply, it's sort of like, think of this way. 100, at 10, you're kind of 100%. At 70, you're kind of 70%. 33, you're kind of 30%. Mechanically, that means I'm firing at your squads, Al. Your squads are suppressed down to 3. Well, they fire 30% effectively, meaning Al and his buddies are keeping their head down. They may be shoving the gun over the top of the wall and firing some because they know the officer might be unpleasant or shoot them or something if they don't, but they're doing that. And there's some really interesting evidence in that, which I read early on too. Like, hey, you take people on to just a battlefield, not a real battlefield, and you have them fire a target. Man, they hit the target. They're good. We have lots of videos on YouTube hitting the target. Okay, now, just put some live fire around, roughly. Oh my God, everything changes suddenly. Everybody's down on the ground, occasionally taking shots, right? Because they don't want to die. So you take in suppression, translate as you're sort of, you know, going to ground. Your fire goes down. So your men are firing, but they're not doing a lot of damage or suppression of the enemy because they're suppressed. Their morale is down. Try to move them. Burden command. The units will increasingly not move forward, meaning they'll move less, right? Okay, Captain, yeah, I really want to move forward into the machine gun fire. Okay, I know I've got to. But, gee, strangely enough, I keep falling down and crawling. And, yeah, I get back up, and then somehow I'm back on the ground as the machine gun fire goes over me. Remember a personal account? The author has a book, it's true, and it starts with, you know, I stood up, it's 1945, and I did the leadership thing, and I led men, let's charge across the field, across the machine guns. And I got out and I started charging. I looked back and none of my men, and he'd been a good leader for a long time, were up following me. And then the bastard of a writer like stopped and went back to like 4 years before. I was like, wait, what happened? So he had to read the rest of the book to find out. But my point is morale. So the troops, if they're at 3 morale and you ask them to assault, they're going to reject it. Now, do they like say, no, you know, screw you, you know. Nobody, it's tricky to do that in the military, but it's just subtle. Oh, yeah, okay, of course I'll charge. And then, I stumbled and fell. But I'm firing, sir. I'm trying to do my job. You know, there are many ways when you don't want to do something to not do it and appear to do it. So your units, if you let them be suppressed, their morale go down, they move less forward, though they're quite willing to move back to get out of line of fire. And you see that in war all the time, right? That why did leaders withdraw their men because at some point they need to be gotten out of line of fire and rallied, so they'll go forward again because they won't move forward effectively if you don't. So in Burden, sometimes you might decide, oh, look, I just got to withdraw a little bit here and put the men behind this hill line so I can get my platoon back together and then attack again. So it affects fire. It affects your willingness to do action. This is another realism challenge with players. Players hate not having things do exactly what they tell them all the time, because every game known to man, I exaggerate some, if you order the unit to do it, it does it. Though you notice later XCOM started to do some interesting things where units would sometimes, you know, freak out, not do what you wanted. But we had to be very careful about that. So one of the complaints we had in the demo was, hey, you know, I did everything right. I did the bolster you told me to with the leader. leaders are very important in getting people to do dangerous things like assault. And yet they, three times, they didn't assault, even though I ordered them to. That's frustrating. I'd be frustrated in that situation. They had bad dice, basically. Because when you take green troops, this is based on some studies, and you order them to do something like assault, and you give them a good leader, it's about 70% chance if you got everything going right. No, I was trying to enforce that, but it's frustrating. So we went back, talked to Dermot Rooney about it, and now, even though they're green troops you're working with, if you flank first, then you can get essentially 100% chance, but you got to work to flank, because it's hard to get on somebody's flank. But in war, he agreed that if you can see you're flanking them, you feel pretty good, because you know the other bastards are going to be, they're going to freak out when you attack them from the flank. Think of Chancellorsville, for those who know Civil War history. So we had to make accommodations on the realism, but it's not unrealistic that. But we had to go back and think, the gameplay is too frustrating for people. How can we, the player can sit there and say, well, if I do all the right things, and I do flank, and I do bolster, and they're not suppressed, then I will get that assault. But now they have an interesting game decision. Well, God, I've only got so many turns, and I know I got a pretty good chance of passing this, and it, I don't know what's in the woods over there if I do go flank, and now it's an interesting decision. So, last cool thing on this, I'll say there's more to say in that, but you can see the morale is the core. The leaders influence the morale, and the morale is essentially how effective the units are. So, last one, there's a book called All the Way to Berlin by Medal of Honor winner James McGallis. And it's late war, it's Arnhem, you know, bridge too far. American 82nd paratroopers are assaulting across. It's crazy what they did. They went across the River Vaal in the open under heavy fire, tons of German machine guns. They ran across the field under the fire, and they managed to rout the Germans. But it was suicidal. Now I'm sitting there reading that fairly late in development. I'm thinking, Jesus, what would happen in Burden of Command? Well, all the units would be lying in the field, totally suppressed. They wouldn't be doing that. Like, oh my God, I'm just totally failing here. Why isn't my system working here? Because I believe in it. So I went back and I read the book more carefully, trying to think, well, why did they? Very interesting. So he says, I was filled with anger over my friends who had died because of these German bastards. And I wanted to kill them. That's not a nice emotion, but I get it, man. I probably feel the same way. And so he said, he essentially said, I went across that field so I could go kill those bastards. And I felt no moral compunction about killing them. I wanted to win the war and I wanted to kill them for what they'd done to my friends. So that was very telling, very emotional, very psychological. And so that's in the game too. And we call that the Undaunted mechanic. Hats off to David Thompson, the board game designer, his Undaunted series. He said, I wanted to riff off that, and he liked the idea. But Undaunted. So elite troops, highly veteran troops, your troops, under fire, will actually not do all the things I just said. They won't go to ground. They won't suppress past a certain point. They might keep their head down some, but they'll keep moving and assault that German line. And then the enemy line may say, oh my God, I'm not staying around for bayonet and break. Now, that sounds all cool. I'm going to get my superhero inhuman soldiers who will be undaunted and run across all the time, be tough ass. Yeah, well, yeah, you may get that, but you also may get a lot of dead soldiers because you didn't do the suppression anymore and you ran across the field. No, wasn't it admirable and heroic? And yet Dearborn is lying dead in the field after fighting for you for 4 years. And this squad is a wreck because they took the position, but they lost a third of their men.
There's a lot to think about, isn't there? It's just listening to this, I don't know, I think it's going to be a really emotional hit playing this game, and I've got a sneaky suspicion that that's what you're aiming for. You want people to feel this.
Exactly right.
Yeah?
Absolutely right.
Okay.
Yes. But, you know, Band of Brothers, I still remember the intensity of that moment when a poor bastard officer, he gets his legs blown off late war. Oh my God, you know, it was terrible. So, war, there's a book, again, called What It's Like to Go to War, Carl Melentes, who is a very successful novel writer about the Vietnam War. Remarkable man. He was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford in the Vietnam War, and he resigned from being a Rhodes Scholar and went and fought as a lieutenant in Vietnam. How many people did that? He could have sat it out. What's some good cause? He got a Rhodes Scholarship. Shouldn't give it up. So he wrote a really compelling book, read early. I had the writers read, called What It Is Like to Go to War. And there's a really interesting opening chapter. I think I have it right. It's called The Temple of Mars. He says, war is spiritual. Now, I bet some listeners are saying, what the hell? What do you mean war is spiritual? It's hell. Well, next line is something like, he said, I didn't say it was good. I said it was spiritual. Because what is more spiritual than death? Than, you know, the death of you or others around you? He said, it might be hell, but hell's a spiritual place. It's just not a positive spiritual place. But, of course, there's also heaven sometimes, because you see people sacrifice themselves for others, which, as I said earlier in the podcast, is a form of love. So, he says, when you go to war and you see the first casualties, you have entered the Temple of Mars, and you have no choice but to be in a spiritual plane. So we actually internally titled our first act in Morocco, Temple of Mars. And our conscious design principle, in the way you asked, Al, is we want to put you in the Temple of Mars and open your eyes to war. Not so propagandistically, it's all bad or it's all good, but the emotional complexity of it and the often emotional intensity. Now, I don't want to overpaint this. Oh my God, it's all high drama all the time. I think you guys probably may have heard the quote, you know, what is war? Long periods of boredom punctuated by moments of sheer terror. So, you know, that's reality. And we don't want to put you through endless boredom, you know. Yeah, go join the army if you want a lot of that too. And my wife's a vet, one of my sons a vet, my dad was a vet, so I have some connection, and we have a lot of vets in the project. Yeah, you know. A lot of it's paperwork. But anyway, yes, emotional intensity. Again, like Band of Brothers, or pick some other book that spoke to you emotionally, because that's the truth of it. And other thing, I keep a quote here on my desk here from a game designer, Bruno Cathala. Most designers focus on the theme, mechanics, and components when developing their game. I agree with this method, but what interests me the most is the player's experience and what emotions the game makes the player feel. To me, that is the core for me of game design, right? I want you to have an emotional experience. The writers want you to have an emotional experience. Steve Overton wants you to be screaming at the monitor, ideally, when the Germans counterattack, right? How unfair it is, because guess what? War is not fair. fun aside, this is interesting with gamers. Gamers are trained to win. Always win. Always take the hill. And I talked about men versus mission. But real commanders, well, I used to say retreat, but then the vets say, you never say retreat, you always say withdraw. Real soldiers and commanders order withdrawals. So there's a withdraw button in almost all scenarios. Not all. Almost all scenarios. And when you get to a certain level of casualty, you can start to choose to withdraw, which will take you off the map. Why would you do that? Because you're starting to think, I'm going to fail the mission condition. I'm in danger of failing the men condition, so maybe I'll withdraw. And one of our design concerns was to, can we get players to actually try not to quote-unquote win like real commanders? And we tried to solve that by having these two victory conditions. But again, you know, to, on the sort of emotional side, get to that aspect of real command where you may make humiliating, maybe, decisions a little bit for you personally, where you withdraw, but you can at least feel like you did take care of your men because you were that kind of leader. But maybe you shouldn't have. Maybe you should have taken a hill and lost a lot of people. So, because in the end, aren't you here to shorten a war so a lot of other people don't die? It's complex. Mm.
So I have another quote from a game designer, which I'd like to. So you've been quoted as saying, our respect for you is a problem.
So give me the context of when he said that. Can you give me a little more on that?
It was on your... said this.
Uh-oh. Oh, yes.
It was a long time ago. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, it's been a few years. Okay, give me a break.
So yes. our respect for you is a problem.
Yes, it was a dead vlog. Our respect for you is a problem. Oh, yeah, yes. That's on the history thing. I remember now. It's going to be really embarrassing. I couldn't remember. I have to check into the senility ward, I guess. So anyway, yes. Well, I've said some of it, right, which respect is a problem. So if you're going to respect the history, then you have to do things like do the If you commit to being respectful, like Band of Brothers does, like art we wanted to do, then you pay a price. You do four Fs when people probably, for familiarity and convenience, want it to be bang, 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 you're dead. Right? So you pay a price there. Then if you want to be respectful of the situation, then, well, that was a problem, right? So what would have been cool, our Band of Brothers had the privilege of recreating real people's lives, and since they're following a history, you could follow real people, right, and do what they did. We can't do that in a game. And respect was a problem. Remember I mentioned this early on. Who the hell are we to go take real soldiers and decide what they would have done? We're not. We didn't face death in 1943, you know, in Sicily. I mean, give me a break. It's a goddamn game. So therefore, we couldn't do like Band of Brothers did and say, oh, well, you're actually winners. Oh, well, you're actually this guy. Go do what you would have done. I think that's highly disrespectful in a game, right? Unless you get the permission of that individual. So we had to. How did we solve that? Well, our solution was fictional company, nickel company, inside cotton balers. There is no nickel company. But otherwise, we organize them like a real company. They go to battles like real cotton balers did. Strangely enough, they show up on some of the most interesting points in the John McManus's cotton baler book. What a surprise. American Courage. But that's an old device, actually. If you look at good historical novels like famous one, Herman Wolk's Winds of War, strangely enough, the family there that are fictional, oh, wow, they happen, one of them happened to be at Pearl Harbor at the time. Strangely enough, they were in Moscow on a diplomatic mission right at the point the Germans approached Moscow, etc. But that's a very respectful book that tries to be, you know, tries to talk to the history. And so we use the same device. I'm not saying we are super creatives or figured out, but, you know, we went through a design reasoning process. We use a fictional company so that we can, you know, go to the interesting places and yet still be respectful of history, do the real fights and so forth. We were totally respectful in the most extreme sense, right? Realism. And we picked one real company, for example, let alone real people, and followed it. Well, I'm afraid it would be a less interesting game because many companies were like, okay, you're guarding the rear, you know, or you had one big battle, 43, and the soldiers were very grateful, and 44, they didn't. So that's not going to be such a good game. So we get to cheat. So, but it's tricky. And the last one is just cheats on, remember that the Tiger's rule, right? Bend but don't break history. Mm. So, you know, it'd be really cool to bring in some jet fighter, German jet fighters 6 months early so that they can make a really dramatic scene here. It's cool. And I think we can all think of plenty of games that do just that. But then at some point you've broken the spirit of what you did and you lose people's trust too. Now, we will, if there were Tigers in the neighborhood and they could have been ordered in, then we might let that happen because it could have happened, right? I mean, history and games are really interesting in that they let you be in a space where you can make a different decision than was made. And you can, I think that's a different way to explore history. You know, we all sit here. What questions did you decide to ask today? You could ask different questions. You probably have a list and you could ask different ones. You didn't. You could have. It would have been incredible if we'd if we ran this interview again, it would go differently. Mm-hmm. If you ran a certain battle again, it would go differently. That's truth about the history of this podcast. That's truth about the history of a fight. And so a game, putting you there, allowing you to see choices, and we give you lots of choices, can actually, I think, convey better the history in some ways than the book. Books, obviously, are superior in many other ways. Or even a Band of Brothers show. Because we allow you to see if I made you winners, though I wouldn't, right? I put you in that situation where you get ordered again to go over the canal. What would you do? And you know now, since you've been playing, so to speak, right, what the consequences might be for you if you don't. Or, speaking less egotistically, you know if you get discovered, maybe you'll be relieved. And then who knows what schmuck will come in to take over your men for the last 3 months and maybe get more of them killed because you didn't obey orders here in the obvious sense. It becomes suddenly not so obvious what to do. And you think, oh, I would always obey orders, or inversely, I wouldn't, right? It's very different when you're there. But then you have a better understanding of what the real commander faced. I was talking to James Holland and Al Murray, alluded to. Very interesting. They do battlefield tours. They said the moment gave an example, you're in Arnhem, and you stand on the hill where the paratroopers were or where this road goes into sort of a a valley where it's constrained in all sides in the city, you understand why they got so cut up there, because it's impossible, right? It's an impossible assault to go relieve the men at the bridge in Arnhem. It's just the way is so narrow, and there's no way around it, and you can't detour, and you know, and then the Germans are across the river with machine guns, and you just stand there, and you get why it was such a bad battle for the British, and why it didn't go well. And so, you know, we do that in the game. We put you in those situations, and the moment you're there, it just looks a little different when you're making the choice as opposed to sitting in your armchair and reading a book.
That was the last thing that I wanted to ask. It's been an absolute joy, an absolute pleasure listening to you. I'm sucked into Burden of Command now. What's the release date?
Ah, you're a good man. Good man. April 8th. Did I say April 8th? I think I said April 8th. Did I say April 8th? I did. Hopefully 10 a.m. We just announced the price today. Now I'm doing my used car salesman technique. This is my backup career. Things don't go well. So, look, for you today, Al, I've got a special deal for you, Al. If you act in the first week like a decisive combat leader and buy the game the first week, I'm going to give it to you, and only you, and maybe millions of others, we hope, $19.99, just for you, Al. But if you delay, if you're not a good leader, you aren't decisive, I'm afraid it's going to be $24.50. Come on, Al. Look, Luke BS'd pretty well on that podcast. Why don't you buy the game? Plus, guy tried so hard. Don't you feel sorry for him? Buy the game. Okay, I think I got it. I'm a natural used car salesman. And just, Nuno, after the podcast, you and I will have a little conversation. I've got a special deal for you. Should you happen to write an article on this game, should it happen to have some positive words in it, I'd get a special free deal on this game. So, yeah, April 8th, God willing, 19 if you buy then. And help us, please, spread the word. Anybody's listening, we're small. 18,000 games. 18,000 games on Steam last year. Imagine how hard it is to get to any attention. It's hard. Now, a lot of those games are maybe not too serious, but they're still probably about 2,000 or 3,000. We happily were in Steam Next Fest top 10%, so that's good. But it's hard. We don't have a big marketing budget or anything. We're just working hard. So please, please, if you think there's something to what we're trying to do, please go spread the word. Tell people. Give us a shot. Forgive us. We're going to do things wrong. We're going to frustrate you at times. But we're trying to do something new. We're trying to do a leadership RPG. And if you help us, my children will eat. I feel like I should say something like that. But seriously, then we'll do more campaigns, right?
So, and is it early access or is it version 1?
It will be 1.0 release. So it'll be the real game. Now, there'll be bugs, of course, and refinements. But this is an attempt at a full release.
Fantastic.
So, it's not early access.
Fantastic. So
I have to say that I didn't know about the price, and for $19.99, I feel like this is a steal. So if you like World War II games...
Did you hear that, people? Did I ask him to say it's a steal? Right there, you heard Nuno say it's a steal. Steal from a poor guy who can't feed his family. But it's 70 hours of gameplay, so you do get a lot of bang for the buck here.
Yeah, I think so. I can already imagine the comments of saying that Nuno is showing out on the game. By the way, I'm not a journalist, I'm just some idiot on the internet that likes to write about games. So I can endorse whatever game I want, and having played Burden of Command and now knowing that it's $19.99, I think you should definitely.
Now I want to make, let's be very careful about Nuno. He's a principled guy. He's increasingly successful. We were talking about, he's getting large page visits now on his website. I think, Al, we should watch, does Nuno sell out when he becomes a big guy? And suddenly he does show, oh, Burden, I'd love to have you on your podcast with a famous celebrity, Al, here. But it will cost you $1,000.
I wouldn't put it past him. I wouldn't. again, Luke, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Really, the link to the Burden of Command Steam page will be in the description of this podcast and also on the YouTube channel as well. Check it out. Buy the game. Support indie developers. They are the future of game development. Thanks again. Thanks, Nuno, for coming along and looking pretty as always.
Thank you for having me.
Al, thank you for being a great host. Really, you could see you really did get some questions. It got me thinking hard. So thank you.
Cool. Thanks very much.
And we're going to break you of this RTS habit. You got to come on, man. Turn based.
RTS is how I started.
We're trying. We are trying our best to bring him to the light side.
I'm a much more well-rounded and accomplished gamer now.
I like RTS too. Anyway,
thanks again. Check out CriticalMovesPodcast.com for all of our social media. How to get in touch with us, Luke. Again, thanks very much, and keep in touch.
Roger.